turnout, and we really appreciate it. We haven't had a lot, thought we would bring it back, and just, we've had a lot going on with new rules, new forms, and so we thought we would get together and talk about some things that the judges think are going to be helpful to you, as well as take any questions you have. We have some, and you don't have to, of course, write your question down and pass it up. But if you're more comfortable doing that, please do that. But please feel free to shout them out as well. That's absolutely fine. We are have about four topics that we plan to talk about. The first one, we're going to wait till Judge Helfinger arrives. He just took over an emergency kind of thing, and so I'm sure he's there prepping. He'll be here shortly. So we'll pass the rejected orders topic until he gets here. And we're going to move on to the certificate of service form. And what this is about is, as you know, now in Chapter 13 cases and 12s, but really we're really looking at you, Chapter 13 lawyers, there you can strip liens, avoid liens on exempt property, and do cram downs through the plan. But, and that's great, because you no longer have to file an adversary proceeding to strip that second mortgage. You don't have to do a motion. Now, this doesn't apply to government entities, but for regular creditors, for the Deutsche Banks, for the Wells Fargos, for Ford Motor Credit, if you're cramming down an old car, you can do this through the plan, but Rule 3012B, and I've put that in the outline. I don't have the whole rule, but I do have the pertinent parts. I'm trying to find my... I have my outline here, so I thought we could even look at it. Okay, so 3012, Rule 3012, this is the national rule, not our local rule, the national rule, 3012A, determining amount of claim, B, request for determination. When the request is made in a 12 or 13 plan, the plan shall be served on the holder of the claim and any other entity the court designates in the manner provided for service of a summons and complaint by Rule 7004. So that's why we now have this new certificate of service form. And what else has to be served? If you're going to, under Rule 4003, avoid a lien or transfer of other property exempt under the code by serving a 12 or 13 plan in the manner provided for services of a summons and complaint in Rule 7004. Finally, I was just searching for 7004 in the rules, and at the end of the case, if you want to have the lien declared satisfied, this is Rule 5009. The debtor may request entry of an order declaring that the secured claim has been satisfied. The request shall be made by motion, shall be served on the holder of the claim in the manner provided by 7004. So again, these three times, if you're trying to lien strip, avoid it, a judgment on exempt property or a non-purchased money security interest on exempt property, if you're trying to cram down, in other words, value the car at lower than the amount of the claim, we are talking that you need to look at 7004. So let's look at it. 7004, it's pretty straightforward. And we are, to make it easy and clear for everybody, we're just enforcing this the way it is written. Now, can you get away with not following 7004? And will your plan maybe slip by the trustee and maybe even slip by the judge? Yes, it could happen. But if somebody comes back in the end of the case and says, oh no, I didn't get proper service under Rule 7004. Do you really want to have that fight? We think not. We don't want to be judges over it. We don't think that's what you want either. We don't want the creditors coming along and trying to figure out if there's a way that it was missed. And we don't want the debtor's attorneys to have to come back and defend, well, I really da-da-da-da-da. So what we're trying to teach you today, and we've got a new form for you to use, is the best practice so that you don't have to have that fight in the end. The first one that's tricky, okay, is 7004B3. Upon a domestic or foreign corporation to the attention of an officer, managing, or general agent, or to any other agent authorized by appointment or by law to receive service of process. So, it's a corporation. Ford Motor Credit is a corporation. You can't just say Ford Motor Credit at their address in Michigan or wherever they are. You need to serve your plan by first class mail to the attention of an officer, managing, or general agent of Ford Motor Credit. Can you say Ford Motor Credit, attention officer, managing agent? No, you can't just use the generic term officer. Right, judges? Right, trustees? No matter which trustee it is, no matter which judge it is, again, might one slip through the cracks, Todd Esser? Yes, it did last week. But it's not going to serve you well in the end if they come back and challenge. So what we'd prefer you do is ask Alexa or Google or somebody else, who is an officer of Ford Motor Credit, and serve to that person. Glenn.
It also says an agent authorized by appointment or by law to do service process.
Right.
And the DFI website is maybe more current than whatever random information we use to find. So if CT Corp is this agent for service of process,
it works.
Looking at various other sources.
Right.
If you're going to go find the officer, you do the old fashioned way, the modern version of the old fashioned way, right? Go to someplace like the DFI or State Secretary of the state or another state, right?
Sure.
It would be good if you're going to serve somebody like that, right, to mention registered agent for a service and process, right? Because the problem is when we look at it, no one is like going to the DFI website and figuring out whether, you know, unless somebody's actually litigating that issue, we're just like trying to like as best we can figure out does this look like service was proper? So the more help, the better.
Right. You don't want your plan stopped and questioned for service. When, you know, just remember who's looking at these, the trustees' staff, our staff, and we're looking at dozens of them, hundreds of them maybe, and you don't want your plan stopped and make the staff work hard and try to figure out did they serve it or not, because they're probably going to err on the side of no, they probably didn't, and make you serve it again. But I'm going to show you the form, even though I've got more to talk about, that we have come up with. This is going to be a new recommended local form. It's attached to your written materials. It's on the website. And it's called Certificate of Service. And it says on, and that would be the date, I, the name of the person doing the service, and it could be your staff member, it could be your assistant, your secretary, your paralegal, it doesn't have to be an attorney, whoever's actually physically certifying the service does not have to be an attorney, served a copy of the what? Plan, amended plan, on the following persons in the following manner. One, deposited for delivery by U.S. Postal Service, first class United States mail, postage prepaid to the parties, and you check whichever boxes apply. So A, listed on the most current mailing matrix, a copy of which is attached as attachment A. So if you are serving an amended plan on all creditors, which you have to do now, you're going to check box A, you're going to go to the website, print out the most current version of the matrix, please be careful. The version, the first version you created in your office may not necessarily be the most current version. And yes, our staffs actually check. Are they using the most current version? And maybe you've gotten docket notices that said, we noticed that there were three creditors added. We don't see that the plan was served on them. So again, you want to use the most current matrix, and that would be attachment A. Check that box. Here comes B, listed on attachment B. This is where you would list if you're serving to the attention of an officer, general agent, or perhaps if you're serving CT Corporation, the registered agent for a corporation. So what you would want to do when you fill out attachment B is say CT Corporation, blah, 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 their address, agent for Ford Motor Credit. You've got it right there. Perfect. Perfect.
Now
you, well, maybe
could
not.
You fill out a form?
Yes.
What do you do if what do you do if there's noise on the matrix, by which I mean there's persons listed on the matrix because they were listed in the schedule sort of for notice purposes, or they're otherwise get listed on the matrix but they're not creditors? Can you just cross those off and, you know, say here's the matrix, we're crossing off those people?
Well, if you're crossing off people that you're not serving.
Right, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Is that good enough?
Yeah. Is it? I want it to be consistent.
Well, why were they crossed off? This is when you get and you look at that. Why were they crossed off?
Why do you cross people off the matrix?
People cross me off because they know I get electronics.
Okay.
Right. Or maybe that might be another reason, right?
Right. I think that's usually what it is. Or they've... You got better addresses for
duplicates.
Duplicates.
No, that's not right. That's another reason. And, but that you can usually sort of... Most of the time when you glance at it, you can tell that. My only point is that, at least in my mind, what we're looking for is something that it you look at it and you're reasonably confident that service was proper. I mean, at some level, absent full litigation of service, I'm never going to be able to determine that service was proper, right? Because how do I know that the person even put it in the mail? I got a certification, but I don't know. Maybe they made a mistake. Maybe they did the certification. They didn't actually put it in the mail. You know, they were like George Costanza or Jerry Seinfeld looking to see whether or not it actually got down to the mailbox. So what we're really looking for is just, you know, something that it kind of looks like it. And so I think the crossing off, when it looks like you can kind of figure out why that makes sense, like duplicates, for example. If it's something that kind of looked like a creditor but it's crossed off, this is a judgment call, it seems to me, and also it depends on how sort of, how much one wants to worry about it. But, you know, there's sometimes people put little notes on there, we crossed them off because whatever, right? And so that's helpful, too. My only real point about this is we're just trying to figure out, can we get something that we look at and we can be reasonably confident that service was made properly.
Right. So attachment B, again, this is for first-class mail service to somebody who's not on the matrix. It could be the registered agent of a corporation. It could be the corporation with that person's officer, director, or managing agent. It's a first-class mail attachment. B is the first-class mail. Number two is the certified mail. And again, if we go back to Rule 7004, we are talking about service of process. This is 7004H. Service of process on insured depository institution. Service on an insured depository institution defined in the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Act, shall be made by certified mail addressed to an officer of the institution. Let's just stop there. So the general rule is officer of the institution, certified mail. Now, again, can you just say officer, Bank of America? No. You should look on the FDIC website or look on a website and find the name of the officer and put it on there, and you use the certified mail. Now, going back just a second, to the first the distinction between first-class mail and certified mail. As you know, if you file your plan with the petition, the BNC will serve your plan on all the creditors on your matrix by first-class mail. The BNC will not serve by certified mail. So if you're trying to lien strip or cram down on an insured depository institution, and they're almost all, aren't they? Anything that's bank, got bank in its name. There's a few mortgage companies that aren't, but if it's a bank, you have to serve that by certified mail. The BNC will not do that. Shay.
I also wanted to actually ask Sean to weigh in here about the BNC service. So a lot of the creditors that are review players will have filed a preferred address with the bankruptcy court. So even if they're not a depository institution and you put your on your matrix, you know, Jay Smith, CEO of whatever company, and they have a preferred address, is it correct that the BNC is just going to replace it and only send it to the preferred address?
Yes, that's correct.
So you need to make sure and double check and also send it out to those people that need to be served as an officer or a registered agent. Right. Even if you put it in the matrix, it could just be replaced based on the preferred address
situation. Right. And I think some folks have started putting CT Corporation or these professional registered agents on their matrix and thinking, okay, now I've got it covered. The BNC is going to serve that by regular mail. It's going to the agent. That probably works, except would you please fill out the certificate of service and use attachment B and say, or use even C, there's another one that says other method, and say BNC served CT Corporation for Ford Motor Credit. In other words, it help us to understand that that's what you're relying on, and it'll probably be fine. Agree?
If they serve them.
If BNC serves them.
I mean, the safest thing to do if you've got an entity that needs special service in the plan is to serve those entities separately, either in the proper manner, certified mail or United States mail, on, you know, if it's on an officer, on the officer, because a lot of those entities are going to, the BNC is going to substitute.
Not and, for CT Corporation, I don't
no,
think.
No, not for CT Corporation, but if you otherwise have some, if you have, you know, officer, U.S. Bank, and U.S. Bank has some other preferred address,
right,
the BNC
right
is going to send it to that, to the other preferred
right
address,
right, right.
And the BNC, even putting to one side the financial institution issue, if it's an entity that's not a financial institution, it's not going to be served correctly because
right
they're not going to send it to that officer. They're going to send it to the preferred address.
Right.
And so
I guess
and you're not going to know that unless you go look at, you know, what the BNC did. And so, and you know, and that, and then we're going to go looking at that way down the road, and it's going to have to be fixed way down the road when, you know, in some ways the simplest thing is just to either do one of two things. Either don't use the plan to do those things. Use it, you know, there's other ways you can do those things. Or if you're going to use the plan, serve it, have the debtor's lawyer serve it, making sure it complies with 7004, and attach that on with 7000 with the certificate of service, and say here's why it was properly served under 7004.
Right.
You can actually say that, but when we look at it, we can figure out, oh, those entities that needed 7004 service, they got them because here it is.
Right. Your best practice is to fill out a separate and serve separately anybody you're trying, and let's again remember, we think everybody who filed adversary proceedings against Deutsche Bank and Wells Fargo and all those second mortgage holders all kind of get it. Hey, now I don't have to file an adversary proceeding. I can use the plan as long as I use the same kind of service as I used to use. We think that has pretty much filtered through and is pretty well known. What we don't think is pretty well known is that you have to use that same service if you're trying to strip down or cram down on Ford Motor Credit or on UW Credit Union or whoever, if you're trying to value a collateral under 506, not strip a second mortgage on the house, but value personal property such as a car, that is also got to be served to be effective under 7004.
Yeah, it's a big pain in the neck. It's just the, it's probably the unintended consequence of the compromise that went into changing all those rules, including 3012, to try to get everybody, meaning the bankruptcy judges, and trying to get those rules passed. This is what, you know, in order, because people are like, well, we have due process concerns of putting all of this in the plan. So in order to solve that, they made all these things subject to 7004, and then they've created this issue.
Question?
If we have a pre-confirmation amended plan where the initial cram down is in the original Chapter 13 plan, where it's working out, you know, valuation or raising valuation, do you still want 7004 service even if we're raising the initial cram down?
Yeah, because 3015, which talks about the various ways of valuing the collateral, makes express if it's in the plan, it needs to be served under 7004.
Right. Tim, did you have a question?
What about where the personal property is eligible for cram down, but the value is actually higher than the anticipated claim amount? Do you want, because I know that can be tricky for staff reviewing because it's in the cram down section, but it's not
right,
actually going to be crammed down. Do you have
kind of a glitch in the plan that way, right?
Do you have
this
a,
is that glitch he's talking about where you have the collateral, the very rare case where the collateral is worth more than the claim?
But it's not a 910. And the thing, and I can say from the trustee's perspective, the thing I don't want you to do is put it in the 3.3, which is the pay in full hanging paragraph section, because it certainly is probably not a purchase money within 9, 10 days or a year. So please don't do that. And then the service question on if you're actually not cramming the down.
Still serve it? Just
why not,
yeah,
Tim?
That's the easiest answer for us.
Right? What we're trying to do here today and with this form is to just give you clear, bright rules that staff people, yours, ours, the trustees can all follow. And the easiest one would be, you've got a car?
It's not common. So.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to look at the exceptions to certified mail, the first one is interesting. If the institution has appeared by its attorney, the attorney shall be served by first class mail. So
does that work with foreign voter credit?
No, that's not a fine. And I didn't really get this. I thought you could always, if Brad Halberstadt appeared, you could serve Brad Halberstadt. I thought so. But I don't think so now, because if you read the rule, this is for Jay Pittner. And if Jay Pittner's appeared, but Jay, would you? What is your address out there in New Berlin? Because we're supposed to be serving you by first-class mail.
Only if Jay's appeared for an insurance.
And only if you've appeared. And that's not often the case in the very beginning.
Originally doing the plan, who's appeared. I have people say, but Jay was on the foreclosure.
Right. Hello. The best way is ask Alexa who is the president of Bank of America and serve that president by certified mail and on our new form, that's going to be attachment C. By certified mail addressed to the entities listed on attachment C. If you choose this option, you must include the name of the officer for each entity served, full name of the entity, and full mailing address. Then we have an other option, 3, other service method, relevant details of service. If you want to help us understand that you serve CT Corporation for Ford Motor Credit or and I'm just using these names as just to give you the easy example that's coming to my pea brain, but you can use that to try to help us, try to help our staff members make sure that they don't kick your plan out for bad service. We've added instructions here, which just generally refer back to the rule. This form is going to be on our website later today. Both this Word document, which has these instructions, as well as a fillable PDF form. Now, you've got to create the attachments, obviously. We can't give you attachments A, B, and C. So, you know, and you should only attach, if you don't have any certified mails, You don't attach attachment C. Mon?
Question. For cases filed before the rules went into effect, in which you might file a plan modification, for example, that would affect the rights of a secured creditor, are we playing by this rule?
Yes.
Or the rules
You're playing by this rule. These rules are now applying to pretty much every pending case because they apply to the extent practicable. New rules always do that. And if you're modifying a plan now and you're going to change something, you need to follow these rules, these service rules.
What if I don't change anything? What if I'm only changing the unsecured creditors? But my original plan was a cram down and I served that right, and now my amended plan makes the trustee happy. I'm increasing the unsecured percent. Do I have to serve it again under the 7004 rules for that creditor who's not affected? Or do I have to ask the court to limit service? Or should I?
No, don't ask court to limit. You're right. I know that one.
Wait. I got distracted in the middle of that. Would you do that again? No, seriously.
No, it's a good question. If your amendment is only affecting a creditor that does not need to be served by 7004, do you have to reserve the plan under 7004 on the other creditors?
The original plan was served under 7004.
If the original plan was done right and now this amendment...
I think you need to ask the court under the local rule.
Or disturb it.
I think that's what the local rule says. I could be wrong.
That's a good question.
Isn't that what the local rule says?
Didn't you write it?
Well, the problem with the local rule is it's an interesting mental phenomenon. You spend a bunch of time debating various things in the local rules. Eventually, you get local rules. And then a couple months later, you think, I wonder what we ended up putting in that rule. And so I just have to go look.
Please note this little double asterisk thing here. It is not necessary to certify that participants in the court's electronic noticing system were served electronically with the documents by the ECF PACER system. Sometimes we see people say, the U.S. trustee, the trustee. Don't worry about that. We know that they were served. These are for debtors, so you don't have to worry about, if you want to tell us that you served your own client with the plan, whatever, that's nice. You don't have to. If you were a creditor filing something, of course, it's a different story. You're going to want to make sure you're serving that debtor as well as the debtor's attorney. But here, you don't have to tell us that you served Jay Pittner, who's appeared in the case, by ECF. We will figure that out. So what we're trying to do here, again, just to recap, is to give you clear, bright line rules applicable to all trustees and all judges. And if you serve your plan this way, it will not get kicked out. It will not have a docket notice saying, what's going on here? Reserve it. It should go through. And again, just to say the obvious, if one slips through, and they might, don't think, okay, I don't have to worry about that anymore. Because you might have to worry about it down the road, and we really don't want you to have to do that.
So going back to the trustee's question, Local Rule 3015C3 provides, unless court for cause shown limits the notice of debtor requesting pre-confirmation amendment, any party moving for post-confirmation modification, and there's one for pre-modification somewhere. Two, any successive pre-modification amendment must restate on incorporation by reference. Is your point that in here somewhere I'm not going to find that it says what to do with a pre-confirmation amendment? Because I thought it did.
I know it has to be researched. I know what we said.
Yeah, here we go. Any objection? Well, that's an objection.
One of the things that we said in the local rules is that when you amend the plan, you have to serve it every time.
Yeah.
You eliminated the limited service.
That's three. It says pre or post. I just skipped over it.
But if you've already served the...
is that the original plan was already served in the pre... old rules, it was served properly in the old rules back in the fall of 2017.
Or even the new rules, and it was a cram down, and the original plan was served properly, and it some kind of cram down, It's all good, but they're amending or something else.
Here it says, number three. An amendment or modification that provides for the avoidance of a lien or security interest must be served on all affected creditors under 7004. This is...
So Rebecca's point is that, well, it was served at one time properly under 7004. Look, the problem with that is the whole reason to require the amendment and it to be served each time was that the problem arises when there's four or five amendments that do various things, that it took an extraordinary a lot of work, not only for the court, but I suspect even more so for the trustee's office, to go back and try to piece together, okay, this amendment did this, and this amendment canceled part of this, but did something else, and who was this served on? So the solution to that was to have, all the amendments needed to be served on everybody, and they had to state all the changes from the original plan. So then the trustee or the court only needs to look at two things: the last amendment and the original plan. And so I guess if the original plan was served under 7004, right, we would pick that up.
I don't think a secured creditor could come in and say, well, I was when you served me properly with the initial plan under 7004, but you didn't serve the amendment, which
doesn't
change that
me?
Provision.
Right.
Just the manner of service was different.
That would be
you
frivolous,
think that's
Brad.
I agree with that. If it was litigated, and maybe now that you forced me to think it all the way through, maybe it doesn't. The rule says no.
We
but
have to follow the rule.
Does the rule address it?
It does. It says that if the amendment or modification provides for the avoidance of a lien or security interest, must be served under 7004.
The amendment doesn't provide for that. The original plan did. The amendment,
and
whatever,
the amendment
changes the amount
it
unsecured
through.
For, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Creditor agreed to the cram down based on whatever general unsecured portion they may also get from the plan, and then you decide to reduce that unsecured portion for some reason because the income didn't come in or they didn't get what they originally thought they were going to have as the value of that.
They're going to get notice of the amendment saying your unsecured is getting reduced, or I think Rebecca's actually suggesting it's going to go up. But anyway, they'll get notice. The question is, do they have to get notice to this officer who, frankly, I don't know where all these notices go, probably.
Well, I think, you don't think the CEO of Bank of America is checking these? I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, well, let's move on so we can cover.
So it's no? The manner is no, not 7004 for amendments that don't affect the cram down.
If the amendment does, yes. If not, no. That's what I think.
If the amendment is adding a cram down,
yes,
then yes.
Right.
But otherwise,
no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah. So we're going to go back.
Hope we made that all clear.
I couldn't follow the no's and the yeses, but.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Especially when it's a one-off, I mean.
Right. Yeah, I think that's the case. I also included, just for the heck of it, for you guys, the provisions of serving, and this isn't necessarily for serving plans, because the ability to cram down on government entities, the city of Milwaukee, IRS, the state, these are not the same rules, and you have to look at them. However, if you're doing a claim objection, and we're seeing lots of these where the IRS's claim is not showing that the debtor's filed all the tax returns, and now the debtor has filed all the tax returns, and the IRS still hasn't amended the claim, or the city is something, or you're trying to cram down on the city, but you're not doing it through the plan, you're doing it through a claim objection. You have to look at 7004 for how to serve those motions, objections, etc. And they're just as detailed as the what we just went through. And again, you cannot be hurt by following them and saying, attention, civil process clerk. That's what it specifically says. You're supposed to be serving the U.S. attorney upstairs, attention, civil process clerk. So if you don't do that, you know, that creates a question in somebody's mind on my staff, is this claim objection properly served? And if the IRS doesn't come along and respond to it, will you, you know, disallow a portion of the claim? All I'm just suggesting is when you're going to serve something on the government entities, check out Rule 7004 and it'll tell you how to do that.
Yeah, because if it's an agency of the United States, on top of that, you have to serve the Attorney General of the United States, you know. So
that's
then we could debate whether or not you have to have Edwin Meese, Attorney General of the United States, or you can just put Attorney General of the United States.
Well,
and
I
you also have to
Sessions.
You also have to serve the agency. Yeah, it was a joke. And you have to
Alexa.
You have to then a copy of the agency.
We're gonna go to rejected orders, Judge Helfinger.
We saved that topic for you.
Well, it was nice of you. Rejected orders. There's new functionality that allows the court to reject orders. What else do you want to know?
I wanted to point out forms and fees. I've got our website up here, and I'm sure you guys like look at it all the time. But in case you don't, in case you haven't looked at it lately, would you please look with me at this section? And I was under here, forms and fees, and then local sample forms. And we have order guidelines that we drafted. And they say they're simple things, like you need a 3-inch margin at the top. And if you send us an order with a 6-inch margin, because that makes it fit better on the two pages, we're going to reject that. That's not going to get signed. And it needs a certain number of hashtags. Now, if you have more or less hashtags, we probably aren't going to reject the order. But if you don't have any hashtags, we're going to reject the order. The order guidelines also say things like, you shouldn't just title your order, order. The order has to do something. Order granting relief from stay. Order granting extension of time, etc. The order guidelines are going to tell you to please try to be grammatical. And if there's only one debtor in the case, don't refer to plural debtors all along. I mean, forms are wonderful, but please, this is my signature on this thing, and I was an English major. I can't do it. So I don't want to reject your orders. I don't want to send nasty notes on the docket. I truly don't. But I also don't want to sign something that has names spelled wrong and totally goofy grammar and it just isn't something that I would put my name on. So
well,
think about it.
You can have one of those things, like you have a footer, like on the phone that says, you know, signed order submitted from somebody else. Please excuse all grammar and spelling.
Yeah.
No, don't do that.
Work.
Don't do that.
That
so,
would work.
But one thing. This is. I've made this pitch before, but I'll make it again. As part of the local rules, is it 5005? Come on, read my mind. The change in the local rules provided for people filing things in readable PDF format. And that applies to pretty much everything that can be done that way. But it especially applies to orders. And I think, I suspect this is, you know, staff that have been doing this a long time are still sort of scanning things in, or they're not printing them to PDF. And the disadvantage of that is that if it's filed as a readable PDF document, then, you know, we can, to some extent, use the PDF editing tools to edit the order, which is much preferable than either trying to recreate the order or like in old days when I used to mark things up when they were scanned in. So it's much better if they were filed that way, and they just need to be 5005B. Thank you, Judge Ludwig. See, he could read my mind. Oh, wait, no, I told him. So
I could read your iPad.
Right. So that would be helpful on orders. The other thing, when Judge Kelly was talking about forms, it comes up on forms sometimes, too. Sometimes people will file forms, and they'll file, like, the gigantic, they won't print it to PDF, right? You can go in and you drop down, print to PDF the form once you filled it out, so then it's a thing, it's not the form. Sometimes they'll file like the whole form, and so, you know, I could go in there and like change around the form. And not only is that a bad idea because somebody could go in and change it around, because, you know, but more than that, the fillable form itself is a huge file. So that's really the principal reason for having people file things like readable PDFs, other than the fact that then they're searchable and, you know, for orders we can modify them, which is great. But from in terms of like the overall administration of the system, filing things like scanned documents or forms that are still in their fillable state are like a huge electronic storage problem. And so there needs to be an effort to minimize that. All right, nothing about that.
Well, I just
you wanted to talk about rejected orders.
Yeah.
You have questions about that?
No, and I just wanted to point out that here we have lots of forms that are actually orders. If we look at Chapter 13, general forms, for example, order allowing compensation to debtor's attorney, order disallowing claim, order reopening case to file financial management certificate and obtain discharge. Just before you're recreating the wheel, just check the website and see if there isn't a form that we've already said, hey, if you use this language, we're good with it. We get a lot of creativity, and that's great. I love creativity, but, you know, some of it we're just not comfortable signing an order. And we'll reject it or modify it. And if it's a commonly done orders on stay relief, orders continuing the automatic stay past 30 days, all these orders, they've been done before. We've looked at them, and these are the formats that we've approved.
So the rejected order functionality is something that the clerk's office has added to what you all call ECF and what we call CM. So CM is sort of the court side of ECF. And it was something that was brought to our attention when we had some people from the AO come in and sort of look at the court processes and give us some advice or about what judges other places were doing. And
You said AO. Do you think they know who AO
is? Oh, I'm sorry. Good point. You know, that's the problem. You come over here, and the next thing you know, you're like talking in acronyms that no one knows, including me most of the time, what they mean. The Administrative Offices of the United States Courts, known on this side as the AO. So anyways, they came in, they said, well, here's some stuff. And one of those things was there's functionality in the case management system to reject orders and to put in extremely limited, at what, 400 or 500 characters. Characters including the spaces, so it's extremely limited, information about why the order is rejected. And so I guess I'm the only person who does this. None of my colleagues have embraced this. But the information that's at the top, so the order then comes back with something that says rejected. And it's kind of over the top with the reject thing. I get that, but that's just the way it works. That wasn't an election. That was like how the system works, rejected. So it has this watermark, rejected. And then there's usually some explanation of why it was rejected. So sometimes rather than do a separate docket entry that says, here's why I'm not going to sign this order, I'll use this functionality because the system pulls that text into the docket. So then the ECF notice, this is all working how I think it works, should give both the text of the reason for the rejection and the rejected order, so there's a document attached to it. Because when we were doing docket, just plain old docket orders, I think everybody has now sort of gotten past this, but there was some initial problems with at least some persons, how they managed their ECF notices, that if there's not a document attached, they weren't receiving them. So this sort of solves that problem because there's a document attached. And it allows, if I want to deny things, basically just to use that rejected order function and say, okay, I'm rejecting this order and I'm denying it. It's usually sort of without prejudice, and I would use that. And so basically to say, you know, here, this can be, this may be, you may be able to do this, but you need to do it in some other way. And again, sometimes the language is going to sound really kind of odd because it's limited to 500 characters, and because there's that, just it's the amount that is in the signature block at the top, and if you go beyond that, it just doesn't exist. So,
right, odd, he means mean, but we'll move on.
Doesn't let you do smiley faces or anything either.
We're moving to this Form 2831. This is your certification at the end of the case that your plan has been completed. And I'm again trying to find my outline again. But by the way, on our website, Lou Jones Breakfast Club, we have all the Lou Jones outlines and audio, so you can actually go back and listen and say, "I thought he said that," but that's all here. But I'm clicking. Yes, I was.
That's great. You're walking the dog. You can listen to.
It's like a podcast.
Sweet.
Okay, but here we are on Form 2831. This is our local form. It's actually modeled after the national form 2830. We have a 2830. That's for Chapter 12 cases. So that's why ours is 2831, and the national form is 2830. And you're all familiar with, Chapter 13 practitioners are familiar with making the certifications about DSOs. That you guys have been doing for years, and, you know.
I'm not going to write that down. Ask me what that means.
You're going to, domestic support obligations.
As a wife.
But what is fairly, quote unquote, new in this form, is certifying this 522Q certification. Now, I put in the outline the discussion from the eminent treatise Ginsburg and Martin on bankruptcy, the discussion of what 522Q is all about. And what it says is, before a court can grant a Chapter 13 debtor a discharge, the court must make a determination that there's no reasonable cause to believe that Section 522Q may be applicable in the debtor's case. So now what does that mean? 522Q. 522Q limits the state homestead exemption to $160,375 per debtor. Doesn't say that, but that's right, per debtor, if the debtor has been convicted of certain felonies or owes debts arising out of certain fraudulent, criminal, willful, or reckless conduct. 522Q. Okay, I've been doing this, this came out with BAP CPA in 05, so clearly I've been doing this since 05. How many 522Q applications have I seen in the Eastern District of Wisconsin in that year, in that those years period? Zero. Rebecca, have you ever seen one?
No.
Len, Shay, nobody's seen them. Why? We don't have a $160,000 homestead exemption in Wisconsin per debtor. And the only way this would apply is if the debtor moved from a place like Texas with an unlimited homestead exemption within the time period and is claiming that homestead exemption, and the debtor is this criminal felony guy. It's not going to happen.
Do you ever have an exam question like that? Debtor moves to Wisconsin from Texas.
Right.
Complete Chapter 13 plan. Use Texas exemptions. Claim homestead exemption of $180,000.
This is why they don't have me teach at Marquette anymore, because that was the final exam. No. No. It doesn't apply, guys. It's not going to apply unless your debtor has moved from a state with a much higher homestead exemption. And, I mean, not Illinois, not Iowa. I mean, we're talking Texas, right?
OJ. OJ moves to Wisconsin.
OJ, possibly. So the answer to this Part 2 certification is what?
No.
The first one, I have not claimed an exemption. Now, I don't know why, you know, if you go down in the form, you know that this form is being signed by the debtor, not the debtor's attorney, although the debtor's attorney is filing it with the court most of the time. So the debtor's attorney should be involved in, presumably, helping the debtor fill the form out and explaining to the debtor what it means. I can't tell you how many of these I have received. More than a handful, where they have checked the wrong box. And they have checked that they do have this homestead and that 522Q may be applicable to them.
Yeah, I mean, look, the form, right, is just to allow us at the end of the day to say, oh, yeah, the record supports that we can grant the discharge. And so it would help everybody if the form was filled out correctly. Because that's all we're looking for is something in the record, right, that says, oh, yeah, like there's support for these things that 1328 says the court has to find.
And I can go back and look. Does the debtor even have a house? And the one of them, they didn't. They didn't even have a house. So clearly I knew, but, you know, if it was a pro se debtor, I would get it. And, in fact, Judge Ludwig had this form filed by a Chapter 7 debtor with her petition because she found every form on the website.
Put them all up.
Put them all up.
The 12 form, the 13 form.
But I don't want to, I mean, please look at this form. And now that you know what it is, what 522Q and, you know.
I still don't really know what it is, but I just know it doesn't apply.
I've explained it to you right here. But anyway, now let's look at the other one that we're seeing problems. This is the certification about direct payments outside the plan. That's what I call them, direct payments outside the plan. We are having these boxes checked wrong as well. My Chapter 13 plan did not require me to make any payments other than payments to the trustee. I think that's pretty plain language, but we have people check that box, and then the next day in comes Jay Pittner's or Chris Drought's a response to the trustee's notice of final cure. The debtor is 4 payments behind on their mortgage that they were paying outside the plan. So I don't know what the disconnect is here, but we are requiring, given the Judge Helfinger's Bethy case and some of the other cases, that debtors have to certify that they're current with the payments they made outside the plan. And this is the place to do this. And if they're not, first of all, don't check that they don't have any. That wouldn't be the way to get around it. Oh, I just didn't really have any. I mean, if you don't have any, fine, check that. And then the other one says that they did have payments outside the plan, and they're current. And now current is a, you know, it's a relative thing. We can have arguments about that. I mean, if the plan completes in May and Jay Pittner's, Chris Drought's thing comes in July and says they're due for June, you know what? They completed in May. They were current in May. They're good. They can have their discharge. This is the way I'm looking at it. But if they complete in May and Jay Pittner says they haven't made a payment since February, now we have an issue. And there's things that you can do about it. Everybody's now kind of getting used to this scenario, and there are actions you can take. Modify the plan and surrender the property. You know, that kind of thing. If the creditor has gotten relief from stay and they're not direct payments anymore, we're not even really paying much attention to it. But my point is, if this debtor is trying to save that home and has been making payments outside the plan, the box that says it didn't require me to make any should not be checked. And the box that is checked that says I'm current, if the creditor comes in with a response that says no, they're not, know that the court's going to be looking at that and looking for an explanation of why the debtor's attorney thinks the debtor's current.
So some plans have provided, especially older plans, not real old, but before November of 2017, provided that if the creditor got relief from the stay, that the claim, I don't know exactly what it said, claim basically to convert to be an unsecured claim, right? I'm looking at Tim Haslow, because I think that was part of the many things that were...
No, they withdraw the claim. The lift stay order withdraws the claim.
Wasn't there language in paragraph 10 that had something in there basically that said it would be treated as an unsecured claim? And
yeah.
Yeah, not maybe it was those ones that was in some, but not all of them, I think. But in any event, so that would handle the problem of the sort of cure and maintain. I mean, otherwise, I think probably a plan amendment needs to be done to say, hey, look, we're not curing and maintaining this anymore because relief from the stay was granted. And I think that's the kind of plan amendment post-confirmation that it would make sense to, that could be just limited to that creditor. And 1329 provides the plan can be modified post-confirmation until all payments were made. And so if there's a payment that's due, I think you're still within the timing for 1329. So a lot of times I think there are potential solutions to this.
Right.
It's just it needs
just
to be considered.
Or object. If your client says we're current and they're showing that we missed a payment 2 years ago, I've got a record of every payment, because when they get behind, then it compounds and it makes it look like they're not. So object. If the client thinks they are current, go ahead and object. Or if they're not, you can modify the plan.
Right. And so, and sometimes when these notices come in and there's a disconnect, at least I'll set an order to show cause. And the order to show cause is really, quite frankly, just a vehicle to try to work out to see whether or not who's right, or is there an explanation consistent with saying that all the payments were made under the plan, because like the example Judge Kelly gave earlier, it could be that whatever the amount that the creditor is calling for actually might not be something that the court would ultimately conclude was due under the plan. That's one possibility. The other possibility is there might be some other way to handle this. So it's really just, that's a vehicle to deal with the problem. But like Judge Kelly was saying, I mean, the other thing is simply to object to the notice, and that would tee it up also. So.
Right. So we're pretty much out of time, but we want to talk about one more thing. It's a new event in
settlements.
CF. Encouraging settlements using the new settlement event. So what this is an event. What happens on Fridays and Mondays in my chambers is the phone rings or emails come in to my staff saying, this case, have settled. And we don't need the hearing. And we're going to get the stip and order in, in due course. And we've tried to standardize and make easier and prevent those phone calls and emails. And rather than making the phone calls or doing the emails, and we like to have both parties on the line, and sometimes the attorney's not available, and that question is the staff member okay on the phone to settle this, judge? Yes. So, but anyway, now we have this event, and the debtor's attorneys can use it as well as trustees, although I think until we get up and going, it's just best to let the trustees use it. And it's a notice of settlement, and what it says is and it relates back to the document, whether it's an objection to confirmation or an objection to dismiss. And it says the parties have resolved this and suggests that the hearing may be canceled and a stipulation and or order will follow. And then the trustees are following up with a stipulation and order, or just a proposed order that takes care of it. So, I mean, why do we love this? Because we know realistically that many, 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 if not most of the cases on our Tuesday calendars are going to settle. And if we can get the ones settled and taken off the calendar, then we can spend our time focusing on the ones that have not settled and that are still on the calendar. And we can do our job, which is resolving disputes, rather than just having a whole bunch of cases that have all been settled and we're just moving on. So from our aspect, this using this event, making it as easy as possible to remove these cases from our calendar, it just makes life so much easier for us and our staffs. And it should give you better attention on the cases that really are in dispute and really can't be settled. What's in it for you? Well, you don't have to figure out, okay, it's Judge Helvinger, so I can't call. Can I email? What do I do? No, you just use the event. And do you, you know, what's in it for the trustees? They don't have to chase you down necessarily for a stipulation. As long as they're confident that they've got the agreement with you, they can go ahead and put the settlement event on and then follow up with an order, don't even need a stipulation, it's an agreed order that takes this thing off the calendar.
Okay, so here's the one critical caveat to that I have. And I'm going to look at Ms. Marcinowski, who's not looking at me. Because it's probably mainly a trustee's office thing. Is that if it's going to be, if this is all going to go forward on just a proposed order, the proposed order needs to state at the top that the lawyer submitting the order represents that these are the terms of the deal. It can't simply be an order that says this order, the motion's denied subject to the following terms, because if that's all it is, I have no way to know that that was actually the deal. And so if this is the way I look at it, put yourself in the spot of someone looking at this record, you know, a year from now, right? Goes up, the whole thing goes up, kit and caboodle goes up to the district court or the court of appeals. And somebody's looking at this record and they're trying to figure out, why did Helfinger sign this order? There ought to be something in the docket that allows them to see why Helfinger signed the order. And so if there's a proposed order that says the lawyer represents that these are the terms of the deal, somebody could look at that record and say, well, that's why Helfinger signed this thing, because there was a proposed order and somebody warranted that these were the terms of the deal. But if all there is an order that says a proposed order says the motion is denied subject to the following conditions, the person looking at that is still wondering, why did Helfinger sign that? What, there was no hearing. There's nothing in this record. We can figure out why he signed this order. So that's why, you know, I'm looking for something that says, okay, we're warranting that these are the terms of the deal, and then, yeah, I'll sign that unless somebody
tells
me otherwise.
Without a stipulation. So this event is when you don't have a stipulation yet in hand. You can certainly, if you guys are organized and everything's, you know, good to go, you can certainly do a stipulation and proposed order and settle it without this event. Absolutely not trying to discourage that. But we're trying to catch the ones that are not like that and are being... calls are being made, take the hearing off because we've settled and now it's going to be 2 weeks and make the staff chase down a stipulation. No, it's going to be, it can be done this way. A couple of things cannot be settled this way. If the court set the hearing, like sometimes I'll see a plan and I'll go, I don't get this, even though the trustee doesn't have a concern, I will set a hearing on confirmation of the plan. You can't settle that with the trustee and say, oh, we've figured that one out, Judge. No, that if the court set the hearing, no, then you can't. If it's an evidentiary hearing, you shouldn't use this. That you should, and please settle those all the time, please, all day long, settle them up. But you should have your stip all set before that comes off, correct? They shouldn't really be using the settlement event and saying, these are the terms of the deal under which we've settle this evidentiary.
No, I guarantee you that if I've set an evidentiary hearing on, for example, you know, current creditor's objection to cram down, and somebody tries to tell me that there's, you know, uses this event, I won't take the hearing off.
Right. So that won't work. Motions for relief from stay. Question is, can those be settled? Yes. However, the proposed order, the stipulation, must say that the debtor, the opposing party to the motion for relief from stay, has a reasonable chance of prevailing at a final hearing. So if the creditor is willing to agree, we're going to settle this, and the debtor has a reasonable chance of prevailing at a final hearing, you can use this event and settle lift stay motions.
And we're doing a separate docket event, canceling the hearing.
Right.
So, I mean, do make sure that the hearing is canceled, because it's, you know, 99% of the times with the common stuff, these hearings are going to be canceled, right? But there's always possible that the judge has looked at this in, like, in advance and has seen something about this that he or she still wants to have the hearing. So do make sure that the hearing is canceled.
The question came in, well, how late in the day can we use the event and get the hearing off? And, you know, frankly, you could do it 5 minutes before the hearing, but that really doesn't serve the purpose of it. The purpose of this is to remove these matters that are settled. Everybody knows what the deal is going to be. You just don't have time to draft up a stipulation. And that it seems to me that that should be able to be done Friday before the Tuesday calendars. I mean, I'm not saying you can't do this on Monday, but I'm questioning.
Well, so it would only be by grace of God that we actually noticed it if it was literally 5 minutes before the hearing.
Yeah.
I mean, because we don't get instant, like you all probably, we don't get instantaneous notice of every single thing that's filed in every case. Otherwise, I would never
explode.
Be able to find
right.
any emails.
If you do it on the morning of the hearing, the likelihood is the case is going to get called and the judge is going to be going, where is so-and-so, because this is on my calendar. But yeah, could you do it on Monday? Yes, but please try to do it on Friday. That is really is going to be encouraged.
So the whole point of doing this is to make it easy for you, to give you an easy route to get these things resolved, because sort of for context, on a Thursday or Friday, we'll have, and I just have one of the trustees, so we'll have 75 matters set for hearing the following Tuesday, and they all ultimately go away, but there's lots of calls. If you can use this event efficiently to resolve things Thursday or Friday before and have that list shrink down to 15, which is what we usually have, 20, and you do that so my staff doesn't have to spend all that time prepping all 65 cases when we only have end up with 15, we will love you. So we put this in place as a tool for you to make things easier for us. So again, it's an easy thing to do. Try to get it, if you can get it done Wednesday, Thursday before, that's ideal.
It's brand new. Scott Lieske and I and my chambers tested it, and it seemed to work smooth. So now it's available to all the judges, both trustees. Again, you could try your lift stays rather than, you know, having the hearing. If you're just going to announce a settlement in, you know, at the hearing, and you just don't have the ducks in a row to have the actual stipulation drafted before the hearing, you know, use the settlement event and say it's settled and that the stipulation will be filed promptly. And then you can follow it. The hearing will be taken off. But again, I think you need to say when you use the event that the creditor agrees that the debtor has a reasonable chance of prevailing at a final hearing. That's coming right out of the statute and the timing required by Section 362. Len?
So is this just no party to the dispute and uploads the settlement event?
Yes.
So when a pro se debtor uploads the settlement event saying, I'm settled with Mr. Kinder, please remove the
file. Yes, definitely, for sure. All the way off. Yep, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Instant, no. The pro se's aren't electronic filers, so they won't be using the event. Any other questions? We're out of time. Thank you so much for your attention.
Yeah.